I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Temple Grandin has a doctorate in animal behavior and a thriving consulting practice in the meat industry. She's credited with revolutionizing animal movement systems, but she also happens to be autistic, and unlike most people with that condition, she is not remote, inaccessible, or obviously unable to function. Her first two books, Emergence and Thinking in Pictures, described her unique autistic perspective, and her latest, Animals in Translation, draws upon the things she has learned as she's worked with animals, especially her insights into how her thought processes have much in common with theirs. Her book is published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased to welcome her back to the show. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Katherine Johnson, who helped you write this book, says that you struggled in writing it because you felt that you had two books. What were those two books?
Well, you can get a book on autism, and you can get a book on animals. Now, one of the things that I want to credit Katherine Johnson for is making the book sound like my voice. The way we did this is we spent hours and hours and hours and hours interviewing, because in my previous book, Thinking in Pictures, that's much more technical kind of writing. I'm a good technical writer. But Katherine knew how to capture my voice, and we spent probably 3 weeks of phone calls, of solid phone calls, over a two-year period so she could just hear me talk about the different things.
Because you had to communicate ideas to her, ideas that initially you think of in pictures, as you pointed out in your previous book.
Well, the way it works is when I use language, language narrates the videos and slideshows that I see in my mind. It's sort of like if it was a courtroom trial, the jury deliberates in pictures, and the verdict is given in language. That's the way I think.
So, whereas most of us think in language.
No, I don't think in language. Now, we get into something that's totally new material. It always comes up as pictures. Mm-hmm. Like somebody asked me, enjoyment at the beach. I was asked in one interview. Well, I started seeing pictures of when I was a child, really fun things we did at the beach. And I don't have any adult memories because I've lived in the West for years and there are no beaches. But enjoyment at the beach brings up pictures of hunting for sea glass, of flying my kite on the beach, riding waves, diving off the pier, just all the fun things we did.
Of course, I have similar experiences when people ask me about memories of that sort. So we're really talking about the way thought appears in a spectrum, aren't we?
Yes. I mean, visual thinking is a spectrum, and I find it varies all the way from a few people that have no visual thinking at all. And the way I test visual thinking is I'll say, access your memory on church steeples. Now, most people...
I see a church steeple immediately.
And the reason why I ask church steeples is I want to ask something that people are not as familiar with as house or car. Most people, if I ask them, walk through your own house in your mind, they can do it. I've run into a few people that cannot. But the most common answer to the church steeple question, and I have to make sure they're not seeing one at the time, is they see sort of a vague, generalized one. Now, for me, there's no generalized one. There's only specific ones, like the church next door, the church at the end of the street, the church I went to as a child. And if I put those up on the screen in my mind, I can turn them into videos. You want it snowing, you want it a nice day, you want lots of traffic around it, I can do it.
What led you to conclude that the way you think had more in common with the way animals think than with other people?
Well, first of all, animals do not think in words. So, okay, if we take words away from animals, then how can they possibly think? Well, they have to think in images, in sounds, smells, and touches. And what they do is take these different, very detailed images and put them together into categories. And categorization is the beginning of concept formation. When I was a little child, the way I sorted dogs from cats was by size. But when our next-door neighbor got a dachshund, now I was trying to figure out why this dachshund was not a cat. Mm-hmm. And I found a visual feature that every dog has that none of the cats have. And every dog has the same nose. Now, another way that you could categorize dogs from cats is smell. They smell differently. You could also do it by their sounds, meowing versus barking.
Would animals categorize in the same way?
Yes, they do. They categorize in exactly the same way. I knew a horse that was afraid of black cowboy hats. White cowboy hats were fine, but he was afraid of black cowboy hats because right when he was abused, he was staring at a black hat. That's what he was looking at right at the time he got abused. And there was a dog that got hit by a car. Now, you'd expect him to be afraid of cars. No, he became afraid. The piece of pavement he was looking at right when he got hit, and he wouldn't walk over that piece of pavement.
Is there a physiological explanation for the brains of autistic people and animals to have these similar ways of relating?
The thing about autistic brains is they tend to be specialist brains. They're going to be really good at one thing and really bad at something else. In scientific research, some of it's been done by Nancy Minshew, Carnegie Mellon University. What Nancy has found is that there's less connectedness between the different parts of the brain. I sort of like to kind of, you know, think of the brain like a big corporate office building. And you have all the different departments in that office building. And normally you'd have email, you'd have faxes, you have phones. But let's imagine a kind of strange office building where maybe the only way you can communicate between departments is by fax. Well, that's going to be kind of unwieldy with the email and the phones out. So what's going to tend to happen is one part tends to just specialize.
So we have the frontal lobes of all of us dealing with this kind of information. And you say that the frontal lobes of autistics are similar, exactly the same as everyone else's. It's the delivery systems into it.
Well, the problem is what the frontal lobes do is they associate all the other different parts of the brain all together. They are sort of they're like the IT, if you use computer talk, the IT center for the brain. Now, what's happened? There's research now done by Eric Corshane that's shown that the connector cables that connect up the computer cables that connect up these different things grow in tangles and don't grow right.
So the information doesn't come in the same way as it does with everyone else. But animals don't even have developed frontal lobes.
Well, animals have frontal cortex. The thing is, as you know, and the more social animals that are highly social have a bigger frontal cortex than animals that tend to be less highly social. And animals have got some savant-like skills. And animals' brains tend to be specialists. You know, certain birds are visual specialists. Dogs are smell specialists. And a Canada goose just has to be shown the migration route once, and he remembers it.
Squirrels hide those acorns and remember where they
are. And let me tell you how they do it. I met the lady who did the research on the squirrels out in San Francisco. Really, really great. And what she said is after the squirrel has hidden the acorn, he rears up and acts almost like he's taking a picture. And I said, that's exactly what he's doing. Because when my work with the meatpacking plants, I got to go to these big parking lots where there's no signs. I mean, it's just a big, open, unmarked parking lot. How do I find my rental car that I can't remember what it looks like? What I do is I get out of the car and I look at the buildings and almost make a picture, and I find some angles in the buildings that I can remember, and that's how I find my car. And that's the same thing the squirrel's doing.
And that's what savants are doing. Not all people who are autistic are savants, but there is a savant aspect to some autistic thinking, isn't there? I mean, in some cases?
Yes, about 10% of autistics are true savants.
Although people who've seen The Rain Man think that everyone is.
No. Only about 10% are those true savants.
So is a savant doing the same thing that the squirrel is doing in a way?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. There's a man out in Berkeley, an autistic savant, and his job is to know where all of the pipes and wires under the streets are. He started out in the mailroom, and then they found out he had this talent, and now he's their specialist to make sure that when they go dig up the roads, they don't break things.
Now, when you are taking that picture, you're looking at something directly. You're looking at me directly.
Yes.
A lot of autistic people have problems having direct eye-to-eye contact. In fact, many actually look at you from the side.
Well, many people with autism have very severe visual processing problems. And looking at the eyes is very distracting, and it's hard for them to hear the voice if they're looking at the eyes. And sensory problems in autism can go from fairly mild. I had problems with the smoke, not we didn't have smoke alarms back then, the school bell going off, and that hurt the ears.
Well, loud noises are a problem for almost all autistic people.
Yeah, most autistics have problems with certain intermittent loud noises. I also have problems with scratchy clothes against my skin. It just feels like sandpaper in my underwear.
And you don't like screensavers.
Well, the problem with screensavers is that I can't take my eyes off of it. And I was in a radio station the other day that had this little psychedelic meter that returned red and blue and stuff like that as I talked. And I couldn't get my eyes off of it, and I mentioned it on the air, and instantly a notebook went over it, and he covered it up.
Because that was really a distraction. But the noises, they evoke some kind of a fear reaction.
Well, and you, pain. It's like a dentist drill hitting a nerve. And, you know, and these things vary. Like one child, autistic child, you can take them to a big supermarket, and things are going to be fine. Another child, you might take them to that same big supermarket, and every single time it's going to be a tantrum because they're just overloaded with too much overstimulation.
And how does that work with animals?
Well, animals, of course, animals' sensory systems work right. In some severe autism, you actually get sensory scrambling. There's the computer cables are tangled up. Animals do not have tangled up computer cables.
But they do sometimes really react poorly to loud noises, to wild visual things.
Yes, you can get animals overstimulated, and this can be a problem with animals in animal shelter. When the dogs bark, it can get up to 120 dB. You know, 90 dB is the OSHA safety limit for 8 hours of exposure for people. It really freaks the animal out. I mean, they're very sensitive. Also, animals, they'll be good at one thing and bad at something else. It tends to be very specific and detailed thinking. Animals are into details. When I do my work at the meatpacking plants, cattle aren't afraid of getting slaughtered. They're afraid of some little piece of paper on the floor, a little reflection, some little shiny piece of metal that moves. And if you remove that thing that attracts the attention, it's like the screensaver or the sound meter in the radio station attracting attention, then they'll walk right up the chute.
So when I walk into that chute, I'm generalizing that thing that is going to distract the cow, I might notice, but it's not all that important. To the cow, that becomes the key factor.
Well, yes. And the same thing I can remember as an autistic kid, I would often get afraid of little details. I remember one time when it rained, and the ceiling leaked and stained the plaster on the ceiling of my room. And I started having visions of all the furniture upstairs piling down into my room. Well, now I know enough about building construction to know that all would happen is plaster would come down and that's all that would happen. But I didn't know that as a child. So I got really scared when I saw that brown spot on the ceiling that nobody else hardly noticed.
My guest is Temple Grandin, who earned her Ph.D. in animal science from the University of Illinois, went on to become an associate professor at Colorado State University, and has written two books on autism, including Thinking in Pictures. He's one of the most celebrated and effective animal advocates on the planet. She has written a new book that deals with animals and with humans called Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. It is published by, who's publishing this?
Scribner.
Scribner. And we will continue our conversation after this. I'm Leonard Lope. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. My guest is Temple Grandin, who has written, with the help of Katherine Johnson, a third book, this one, Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. It's from Scribner. How are you able to draw a conclusion if you're thinking in totally visual terms? Don't conclusions require the ability to generalize?
Well, what I do is I categorize details together into different categories until you sort of find the basic thing that's important. Like in the work that I did on developing the auditing systems that are used by the American Meat Institute and McDonald's for auditing and packing plants, you know, I wanted to figure out what are the really important things to measure. I didn't want somebody's opinion as to what's important. What's really important? Well, I found one measurement that works very well is vocalization. How much squealing of pigs is going on, how much cattle mooing and bellowing is going on.
And you're probably the only person who would have thought in those terms.
That's right. I actually collected data on this, and I found that like when the cattle are going up the ramp and they're in the stunning area, that 98% of the vocalizations were associated with something bad, like being shocked with an electric prod, slipping on the floor, a missed stun, getting pinched in a piece of equipment. I mean, something bad happened. And I had to differentiate between the vocalizations that happened during actual handling and vocalizations of a couple of bulls just talking out in the yard where they're just waiting, and you don't count that. But I had to categorize cattle in the yard vocalization versus cattle in the chute and the stunning area while you are handling them vocalization. And that's the vocalization that you count.
Now, talking about vocalizations, you say that when you were a kid, you were teased for being a tape recorder. But in fact, the people who were teasing you were correct in a way.
They were. They were correct in a way because I just would repeat the same things back. You see, when an autistic person learns things, it is just like tape-recorded, pre-recorded things.
So they're learning by rote.
That's right. But the thing is, the more information I can load onto my hard drive, and I got a big hard drive for visual information, the more different categories I can make it into to make in basic principles. Also, I can use visual thinking in a more abstract kind of way, where I say, okay, the brain of the of a person's sort of like an office building, and the brain of the autistic person's like this office building with all the phones and the email broken, and they just have faxes.
Mm, so in a way, you're even thinking metaphorically.
Yeah, but the metaphors are always pictures. And when I think about that, I'm actually imagining actual corporate offices that I've been to. What would it be like in those corporate offices if fax is all they had? And I'm imagining that you would set up trunk lines of faxes, you know, where one part of the thing that would specialize and everybody else kind of gets left out.
You say that you talk out loud. How does that help?
It sometimes just helps me to consolidate my thoughts. I don't, you know, do that so much now. But when I'm designing equipment, I'll be drawing on the drawing, but I'm saying like, ooh, we could just get a welder and we could do this. Ooh, this is going to work, while I'm actually building it in my mind. The actual designing happens completely visually. And as I work on drawing a drawing, I can actually build the entire cattle handling system in my mind. I can do it like 3D virtual reality computer. I didn't even know that was a special talent. I thought everybody could do 3D computer in their head until I started questioning people about how they think.
Mm-hmm. And they need all sorts of blueprints that lay those things out for them.
Now, the blueprints, now when I look at the blueprints, I see the building. But it did take a time for me to learn how to relate maybe a square on a blueprint to a column in a building. And the way I had to learn that was take a set of drawings. It was for the Swift plant in Arizona way back in the 70s. I took their entire drawings. I walked through the plant till I could find every single column, every single concrete wall, every single piece of equipment on that drawing. And then after I did that, now I can just look at the drawing and see the plant.
When did you begin to discover your ability to identify with animals? Did you have pets when you were growing up?
Pets when I was growing up, but this was sort of a gradual thing. First of all, I didn't realize, you know, that my thinking was different. And then the other big mistake people make with animals is they mix up fear and aggression. Okay, the horse is kicking at you. Is it fear or aggression? And I hate to say it, I did make that same mistake. You know, then after learning more and more about animal behavior, and I've had a lot of courses in animal behavior and biology and physiology, then I was able to take that knowledge and combine that together with experiences, you know, with my own experiences. And that's when I really got the gigantic insight. It wasn't like some magic thing. It's the way my brain works is the more information I gets on my hard drive, the more things I can learn. I can take the academic knowledge. And then in the first chapter of my book, I talk about these horses had all these behavior problems. Now, when I was 18 years old in high school, I didn't realize why Goldie was throwing a fit every time they rode her. And she ride her, it was impossible. Now, you could shoe her, you could walk her, you could groom her. If you were standing on the ground, you were fine. But man on her back, that was bad. See, in the mind of the horse, that's two different pictures. I didn't understand that as a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old. But now I understand exactly what was going on, and Goldie was absolutely terrified.
So there are ways of deciding whether we're talking about aggressive behavior and fear behavior in animals. And again, talk about that for a moment, and then talk about how that applies to autistic behavior.
Okay, first of all, the dog is biting. You need to figure out, is he scared or is he aggressive? Because if he's scared and you whack him, that just makes it worse. Now, with an autistic person, let's say you take a nonverbal autistic person into a large supermarket and they have start screaming and hitting, I'll tell you right now, that's fear. Because the sound hurts, all the lights bombarding them, they feel like they're inside the speaker at the rock show, and that's going to be fear-based behavior. But one of the most important things in animal behavior and working with autistics is it fear or is it true aggression? Because there are some other times where it can be true aggression.
Well, the way that autistics are generally taught is through behavior modification. There are other methods, but that's the usual approach. And you, when you went to college, you studied that. It was at a time when B.F. Skinner's behaviorism was being taught in all psychology courses. What was your reaction to Skinner's ideas?
Well, my reaction was that, you know, operant conditioning and just changing things in the environment, rewards and reinforcement explained only maybe a half of animal behavior. Because I was fortunate enough when I was at the same time to take an ethology course from a retired professor named Tom Evans. And he was a reptile specialist. And when you deal with reptiles, you deal with much more hardwired instinctual behavior. And you know, he'd show how a stimuli would, like, set off a whole pattern of behavior in a lizard. And then as you move up and get into the more complicated animals, there's less and less hardwired and more strictly learned behavior. But there's some things that you can't teach an animal to do. Like, if you want to teach a pigeon to peck a switch, you have to teach him to peck the switch, not put his foot on it. You go too much against innate nature, he's just not going to learn it very well. And I'd learned enough about these other things. I go, wait a minute, this can't explain everything. Because I said to B.F. Skinner when I visited him, and that was like going having an audience with a Pope or something. I mean, when I was a college student, I got a chance to visit B.F. Skinner.
Was he interested in you at all?
He was very interested in my motivation on some of my projects. And I said to Dr. Skinner, if we could only learn about the brain. And Dr. Skinner said to me, we have operant conditioning. We don't need to know about the brain. But my good friend John Rady has known Skinner all along, and Skinner had a stroke. And shortly before he died, Dr. Rady had dinner with him, and Dr. Rady asked him, well, don't you think you have to get inside the black box? And Skinner admitted, since he had a stroke, that maybe we do need to get inside the black box, and not everything can be explained by stimulus response. A lot of things can be, but not everything.
You had problems with experiments involving negative reinforcement. Is negative reinforcement ever useful?
There are a few situations where you might have to punish an animal. If you want to teach an animal a new skill, a new trick, teach a dog how to sniff for explosives, for example. That is all done with positive reinforcement. Most, you know, you want to teach it some new thing, it's all done with positive reinforcement. The only exception to that would be stopping prey drive problems in dogs, you know, like cat killing, car chasing. And prey drive is not the same as aggression. Man, when they're chasing things, they're just really happy when they're doing that. And it's a very strong instinct, and it's stimulated by rapid movement.
My guest is Temple Grandin. Her latest book, Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. It is from Scribner, written with the help of Catherine Johnson. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Negative reinforcement was used for a time in teaching autistic children as well as part of Ivor Lovaas's applied behavioral analysis approach, and it was stopped.
Yes, and it should have been stopped. And if a child is having a panic attack and screaming in the middle of Walmart, you punish them, it just makes it worse.
I understand that actually some of these kids, when they were being punished with a little shocks and things like that, came to like it, and because the stimulation was kind of exciting, and they would do things to get the negative reinforcement.
Well, the problem is if you get into very severe levels of autism where you have a nonverbal person or hardly verbal person, the whole sensory system is messed up. They can have problems with, they do not know where their body boundary is. Like if they put their hand on a table, they can't tell where the table stops and their body begins. And you can get some situations like that where that shock may have just acted as a signal, but there's other nicer signals you can give them.
But there's also a higher threshold of pain in some animals and in autistic people as well, aren't there?
There are some autistic people that don't feel pain in the normal way, and there's some really abnormalities. Another thing I want to mention about autism is just how broad it is. You go all the way from somebody who's severely nonverbal up to somebody who's brilliant, like Einstein. Einstein didn't talk until age 3. And then you have these Asperger's, which is just even milder. And they used to have a diagnosis before, computer nerd.
Well, Asperger's people tend to be really great at math or language, but very bad at socializing. Some people see it as part of the autism spectrum, and some people see it as a kind of a mirror of autism. And there are big differences. There was an article in the Times recently about some Asperger's kids in a special school in Long Island.
Sorry.
They did not want to be given behavioral teaching methods because they said, hey, we are a special kind of people. We have our own way of thinking. We should not be forced to try to be like everyone else.
Well, and to a point, I agree with that, because there's some brilliant Asperger people here, and the problem is, there's different kinds of Aspergers. You can get visual thinking like me, and then you can get a non-visual thinking kind of Aspergers. And there seem to be three kinds of brains. There's a visual thinking like me, terrible at algebra. There is the music and math mind, and then there's going to be what I call verbal logic. They'll be very good at things like language translation, being a journalist, probably would do a good job, working in radio. But the thing is, it tends to be specialized. It's a specialized brain.
So they specialize in the same way that all other autistics specialize, and they have the other problems, the socialization problems. Often they feel uncomfortable being touched. Some of the things that you described as loud noises, the things that you had to do.
Well, they have a lot of problems with those things. I mean, I take antidepressant medication. And I would not be here if I wasn't on antidepressant medication, because that stopped the panic attacks, the constant panic attacks.
But you started doing that when you were an adult. There's a big controversy over whether any psychotropic drug should be given to children who are autistic.
There's way too many powerful drugs being given out way too casually. And one of my big concerns now, they've got a black box warning on all the SSRI, Prozac, type antidepressants because of a slight increase in suicidal thinking, is that those will be replaced by doctors by the atypical antipsychotics like risperidone, which have much more dangerous side effects like diabetes, obesity, Parkinson's disease, like shakes. But most of that problem, the suicidal thinking, was caused by giving too high a dose. People on the autism Asperger spectrum, if you're going to use drugs like Prozac or Zoloft or Paxil, you need to oftentimes use a much smaller dose. And you give them too much, they won't be able to sleep. They'll feel like they drank 100 cups of coffee. And a mistake that doctors make is to increase the dose when you ought to be cutting a dose. I know lots of people on the Asperger spectrum out in good jobs, out in industry, where a little tiny dab of Prozac is helping them to keep their jobs.
You talk about, in the book, about the danger of anthropomorphizing animals. And you tell a story about someone who shipped a lion and thought that it would be more comfortable for the animal to have a pillow to rest on. What happened?
The lion ate it and died. Now, I think what we got to try to do is figure out, if I was a lion, what would I want to lay on? Well, I think I might like some straw to lay on rather than, hard wooden or metal crate to lay on. I wouldn't want to give him something that he could chew up and kill him. Want to give him, if he ate some straw, that's not going to hurt him.
Well, how does this apply to the way people deal with their dogs and cats?
Well, you have to figure out, one of the things is what is motivating the animal. One thing about dogs are not democratic. And people just need to realize that. And if you have more than one dog, they kind of form a dominance hierarchy. And if you have more than two dogs, I've read about some really big messes. That was a book that Nick Dodman wrote where the lady thought it wanted to be democratic, so she always fed the subordinate dog first, and then the dominant dog just kept beating it up. See, what you should be doing is just the opposite. Person, the owner, is alpha, the dominant. And then the dominant dog is, the number two, and the other dog's the 3-4. And the thing is, you'll let the dominant dog do stuff first, and that helps to keep the peace. They are not democratic. That's one thing.
Now, dogs are really wolves that have remained infantilized, aren't they?
That's right.
So what does that tell us about how we should relate to them?
Well, the thing is it's called neoteny, and the degree of neoteny varies. Like you might have a husky, and they actually will have more of the instinctual behaviors that the wolf will have than something like a King Charles Spaniel, which even when it's grown up and it's 5 or 6 years old, still looks like a puppy and acts like a puppy.
So do you think that, and obviously dogs have changed a lot over the years through breeding and through their relations with humans, do you think it's affected the way humans act as well? Have we evolved along with them in thinking about how to relate to pets? Because there are some people who cannot live without pets, and I suspect that in the savannah, people weren't as connected to their animals.
Well, I think in some ways, the ancient cavemen in some situations were, because if you managed to, let's say you raised some wolf puppies And then the mean ones you get rid of. You see, this is already starting the process of domestication. You get rid of the mean ones, and the gentle ones that will come up to you, you keep. And within 20 generations, you've got dogs. It doesn't take very long to do that. Imagine what a benefit having some, you know, wolves or some dogs would be. They'd help you hunt. They'd protect you. Also, you'd learn a lot about hunting because wolves cooperate when they hunt.
So and then they retrieve the prey for you as well.
That's right. And they'll bring it to you because the thing is that domestic dog lots of times will go out and kill something and they'll bring it to you. You know, I mean, think that would be a real advantage.
You've been extremely successful and high functioning within a world that wasn't built to accommodate your differences. But aren't you the exception to the rule?
There are, when you get into the milder Asperger end of the spectrum, these are kids where the speech is more or less normal at 2 and 3 and 4, so nobody's running off at the doctor. And I see these mild Aspergers all over the technical field. I'm going to guess that 20% of all computer programmers are mild Aspergers. We need to have these people in technical fields. And one of my big concerns is I'll see a brilliant Asperger kid come into an autism meeting, maybe 16 years old, got an IQ of 140, and he should be going into university, and instead he's kind of gotten stuck in a special ed rut because these skills are going to be uneven. I couldn't do algebra. And the thing is, algebra just needed to be skipped. And the only way I got through high, the only way I passed college math was that in the 60s they were in the new math craze. So they didn't teach algebra. They taught finite mathematics, which is probability and set theory. And it was difficult for me, but I got a B in it with some tutoring. I got a B in it.
But you don't describe yourself as Asperger's. Although I did read a newspaper report where you said you might be.
Well, there's controversy about, I think Asperger's and autism are on a continuum. The main way you diagnose the two is I had the full-blown autistic symptoms as a little kid. In fact, my mother, Eustacia Cutler, has written about it in a book, and her book's called A Thorn in My Pocket. And then you have the Asperger kid that's just sort of the nerdy, you know, kid loner that gets picked on. It's a continuum. I don't think they are, you know, distinct things. Now, you do tend to get with the ones that have the better language, they turn into language specialists rather than visual specialists. They are still specialized brains.
There are some people who think that Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, was Asperger's because he was both very articulate and very good at math. He taught math. At the same time, he was a loner in all of the usual ways to the point where he didn't want bathe, he didn't want to connect to people, and lived alone in a shack in the woods.
And I've read the stuff, and I think that's probably right. And on the other hand, I want to emphasize there's a lot of other people with Asperger's doing all kinds of really good things. We wouldn't have any computers. We wouldn't even have these radio stations if you didn't have your technicians back there to keep this place running. You know, we need these Asperger people. But what you need to do with Asperger people is they need to be taught very young about right and wrong. That needs to be drilled in. You don't hurt other people. You see, they learn by logic, and they can learn by logic to be good, or they can learn by logic to be bad.
Aren't you also exceptional in another way? As I understand it, something like only one in seven or one in eight autistic people is female.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, is there some reason? We talked about how conductivity of the wiring into the frontal lobe plays a role. We've had a lot of controversy recently about the differences in the brains of women and men.
Yeah,
Larry Summers,
yes,
do you think that plays a part?
Well,
in
there's
this
one thing. Let's just get into hard data rather than, you know, arguing. Men's brains are more lateralized, and let me just give you an example of how that happens. If a man has a stroke, in other words, you know, a stroke damages his language part of his brain, he doesn't get his speech back. If a lady has a stroke in the speech part, she gets her language back. And one of the reasons is the corpus callosum in women is larger, so the brain is more interconnected. It's more interconnections. So I think that makes men's brains more susceptible to damage. But on the other hand, you get into the very mild Asperger type of women. I've seen them all over technical traits. When I go out and I work in the meat plants, they're there. They're some of the first women to get into that industry. And women tend to be more social. And so I think it's easier for an Asperger woman to blend in and fit in than some of the guys because, you know, and I think it has to do with this basic brain lateralization thing. And this is something that's hard scientific data on the stroke thing.
I almost was going to avoid asking you this, but since we have a little more time, everybody wonders why, if you love animals so much, that you develop equipment that leads them to slaughter.
Well, I got to eat. And I went through a whole big long thing about whether or not I should become a vegan. And that's a person that has no animal products, no eggs, no milk. And even the dairy cow has to have a calf every year, and the male calves go to slaughter. Old hens go to slaughter. And I feel very strongly that we can raise animals ethically for food. In fact, when you look at the animal welfare issues with animals, beef is the best. Beef, when they're done right, can have really good welfare. The worst problems I saw, you know, I've done a lot of work for McDonald's, and I got taken into the egg suppliers and getting into the hens that lay the eggs. That was the worst stuff. And a lot of the bad problems were genetic. These animals have been bred so much just to lay eggs, that they became psycho-frazzled nervous wrecks that pecked each other, and all the half their feathers came off.
Well, doesn't that also apply whenever you breed an animal to specialize, whether it's to make turkeys stupid or to make purebred dogs look elegant at a dog show?
You over-select for single trait, and I don't care what that trait is, you are going to ruin that animal.
Thoroughbred horses
I don't
as
care
well?
What it is. Horses, thoroughbred horses have weird problems where when they exercise, they bleed in the lungs.
So we wind up getting this trade-off, but it seems to be unfair to the animal.
Well, I think it is. And I think some of my biggest concerns about animal welfare are genetic, and not just in farm animals, but also in domestic animals. You know, we've got to make sure that any animal we breed is physically and mentally sound. And some of the big problems I've seen both in horses and in some of the agricultural animals is they forgot about breeding for feet and legs. Now, fortunately, the pig people now are realizing they're going to have to start breeding for physical soundness, because when they just went for lean, and lots of lean, they had animals that all kinds of leg problems, and they're realizing they're going to have to correct that.
You say that when it comes to domestic animals, we are the environment. What do you mean by that? Do you mean that for them they live in this rarefied world?
Well, basically, okay, if an animal's living out in the wild, you know, the animals that live in the wild tend to be much more fearful because they need that to avoid danger and avoid predators. Okay, now when they're in our environment, we tend to breed an animal that is calmer. But then the other bad things is we're in an environment where maybe somebody wants a collie that has a nose that's like an ice pick. So you breed for this needle-nosed collie, and then the next thing you know, you got weird eye problems because the eyes don't fit in the sockets right.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's been a fascinating 45 minutes or so. My guest has been Temple Grandin, who's written with the help of Katherine Johnson, Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. It is published by Scribner. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me, and I want to make sure Katherine Johnson gets really good credit because she was able to capture my voice.